So, welcome then. Quite a number again. First of all, now, there won't be any reading next week. I won't be around. So, in 2 weeks again, then. No. And we got stuck in the cab and shelter at the moment when Stephen unfriendly says to Bloom, "We can't change the country. Let us change the subject." In other words, "I'm not interested. Shut up." And Bloom, in fact, does shut up for quite a while. So we go on.
"Yes," he softly imparted in an aside in Stephen's ear, "are accused of ruining. Not a vestige of truth in it. I can safely say, history, would you be surprised to learn, proves up to the hilt, Spain decayed when the Inquisition hounded the Jews out, and England prospered when Cromwell, an uncommonly able ruffian, who in other respects has much to answer for, imported them. Why? Because they are practical and are proved to be so. I don't want to indulge in any, because you know the standard works on the subject, and then orthodox as you are. But in the economic, not touching religion domain, the priest spells poverty. Spain, again, you saw in the war, compared with go-ahead America. Turks, it's in the dogma, because if they didn't believe they'd go straight to heaven when they die, they try to live better, at least so I think. That's the juggle on which the PPs raise the wind on false pretenses. I'm," he resumed with dramatic force, "as good an Irishman as that rude person I told you about at the outset, and I want to see everyone," concluded he, "all creeds and classes, pro rata, having a comfortable, tidy-sized income, in no niggard fashion either, something in the neighbourhood of £300 per annum. That's the vital issue at stake, and it's feasible and would be provocative of friendlier intercourse between man and man. At least that's my idea for what it's worth. I call that patriotism. Ubi patria, as we learned a small smattering of in our classical day in Alma Mater, Vita Bene, where you can live well, the sense is, if you work." Over his untastable apology for a cup of coffee, listening to this synopsis of things in general, Stephen stared at nothing in particular. He could hear, of course, all kinds of words changing colour, like those crabs about Ringsend in the morning, burrowing quickly into all colours of different sorts of the same sand, where they had a home somewhere beneath or seemed to. Then he looked up and saw the eyes that said, or didn't say, the words the voice he heard said, "If you work." "Count me out," he managed to remark, meaning to work. The eyes were surprised at this observation, because as he, the person who owned them, pro tem, observed, or rather his voice speaking did, "all must work, have to, together. I mean, of course," the other hastened to affirm, "work in the widest possible sense. Also, literary labour, not merely for the kudos of the thing. Writing for the newspapers, which is the readiest channel nowadays, that's work too, important work. After all, from the little I know of you, after all the money expended on your education, you are entitled to recoup yourself and command your price. You've every bit as much right to live by your pen in pursuit of your philosophy as the peasant has. What? You both belong to Ireland, the brain and the brawn. Each is equally important." "You suspect," Stephen retorted with a sort of a half laugh, "that I may be important because I belong to the Faubourg Saint-Patrice, called Ireland for short." "I would go a step further," Mr. Bloom insinuated. "But I suspect," Stephen interrupted, "that Ireland must be important because it belongs to me." "What belongs?" queried Mr. Bloom, bending, fancying he was perhaps under some misapprehension. "Excuse me, unfortunately, I didn't catch the latter portion. What was it you..." Stephen, patently cross-tempered, repeated and shoved aside his mug of coffee, or whatever you like to call it, none too politely, adding, "We can't change the country. Let us change the subject."
So... Where Bloom takes up, and I was mistaken there, "Jews," he softly imparted, impart as a saying word, in an aside to, in Stephen's ear, "are accused of ruining," and the sentence is incomplete, "not the vestige of truth in it, I can safely say. History, would you be surprised to learn?" That was also a tune in a music hall. "Would you be surprised to learn from a court case?" "Proves up to the hilt." The sword goes in up to the hilt. "Spain decayed when the Inquisition hounded the Jews out." And England prospered when Cromwell, an uncommonly able ruffian, who in other respects has much to answer for, imported them. So Cromwell did. But of course, Cromwell is a bad name for Ireland as he invaded it. Why? Because they're practical and are proved to be so. I don't want to indulge in any trading off because, you know, the standard works on the subject. And then, orthodox as you are, and of course, Stephen is anything but orthodox, it also, the sentence doesn't stop, it doesn't end. But in the economic, not touch religion, domain, the priest spells poverty. Spain again, as you saw in the war, compared with go-ahead America. There was a Spanish-American war. Turks, it's in the dogma, he thinks, religion. Because if they didn't believe, they go straight to heaven. When they die, they try to live better. At least, so I think. That's the juggle on which the Peepees raise the wind. Peepees is parish priests raise the wind on false pretenses. I am, he resumed, with dramatic force, as good an Irishman as that rude person I told you about at the outset. And I want to see everyone, concluded he, all creeds and classes pro rata, that is in proportion, having a comfortable, tidy-sized income in no niggard fashion, no mean fashion either, something in the neighbourhood of £200 per annum. So that would have been a good income. That's the vital issue at stake. And it's feasible and would be provocative of friendlier intercourse between man and man. We know what he means, but friendly intercourse between man and man could also mean something else. At least that's my idea for what it's worth. I call that patronism. And now he launches into some Latin. Ubi patria, where my fatherland is, as we learned a small smattering in our classical day in Alma Mater, that's university. Now, of course, Bloom has not been in Alma Mater, and you also realize how he brings together Ubi patria and Alma Mater, mother and father. Vita bene. There are several sayings of that sort. Where you can live well, the sense is, if you work. So he's had a long speech. But now I always like the next construction. It's quite unique. Over his untastable apology for a cup of coffee. What is an untastable apology? And we understand what it is. The coffee is very bad. It's probably, the taste is so bad that you could not apologize for it. But it's a great phrase. And I try to translate it. Listening to this synopsis of things in general, Stephen stared at nothing in particular. You could hear, of course, all kinds of words changing colour, like those crabs about Ringsend in the morning. There were crabs, so little crabs on the beach, burrowing quickly to all colours of different sorts of the same sand, and you can hardly see them because the colour blends into the rocks and so on. Where they had a home somewhere beneath, or seemed to. Here for once we're in Stephen's thoughts. Then he looked up and saw the eyes that said, or didn't say, with the words, the voice he listened to, if you work. count me out, the manager remarked, meaning to work. So he rejects it. As his Bloom is very at pains to ingratiate himself and say, and Stephen is reject usually. Good.
We have read more.
Yeah.
Fritz? Fritz?
Yeah. Oh, we read more. I never get my remarks right. Sorry. Count me out. The eyes were surprised at this observation because, as he, the person who owned them for a temporary, the eyes, observed, or rather, his voice speaking did. All must work, have to, together. I mean, of course, the other hastened to affirm, work in the widest possible sense. Also literary labour, not merely for the kudos of the thing. The kudos is a word that actually taken over from Homer. The kudos, as we would say, kudos, is the fame you get from something. The Greek heroes did it not for material. They wanted to become famous, to have an epic about them. Like Achilles and all of that. And this word has survived in student slang and is now common. So merely for the glory of the thing. Writing for the newspapers, which is the radius channel nowadays, that's work too, important work. After all, from the little I know of you, after all the money expended on your education, you are entitled to recoup yourself and command your price. You have every bit as much right to live by your pen in pursuit of your philosophy as the peasant. Notice, pen pursuit philosophy peasant has. What? You both belong to Ireland. The brain and the brawn. Brawn is physical strength. Each is equally important. You suspect, Stephen retorted, with a sort of a half laugh. What is a sort of a half laugh? That I may be important because I belong to the Faubourg Saint-Patrice, called Ireland for short. Because in Paris, you have Faubourg Saint-Geneviève, and now he, in French, Ireland is a kind of Faubourg, he says, called Ireland for short. And then Bloom says, I would go a step farther. What does a step farther mean? You realize he just says something in order to follow, insinuate it. But I suspect, Stephen interrupted, that Ireland must be important because it belongs to me. So that is the arrogant Stephen. What belongs, queries Stephen, bending, fancying he was perhaps under some misapprehension. Excuse me, unfortunately I didn't catch the latter portion. What was it you? Stephen, patently cross-tempered, repeated, and shoved aside his mug of coffee, or whatever you like to call it, none too politely, adding, we can't change the country. Let us change the subject. That's where our first thought it would be. So you see, it's again a rebuff. So now we get the next slot.
This pertinent suggestion, Mr. Bloom, to change the subject, looked down, but in a quandary, as he couldn't tell exactly what construction to put on belongs to, which sounded rather a far cry. The rebuke of some kind was clearer than the other part. Needless to say, the fumes of his recent orgy spoke then with some asperity in a curious bitter way, foreign to his sober state. Probably the home life, to which Mr. Bloom attached the utmost importance, had not been all that was needful, or he hadn't been familiarized with the right sort of people. With a touch of fear for the young man beside him, whom he furtively scrutinized with an air of some consternation, remembering he had just come back from Paris, the eyes more especially reminding him forcibly of father and sister, failing to throw much light on the subject, however, he brought to mind instances of cultured fellows that promised so brilliantly, nipped in the bud of premature decay, and nobody to blame but themselves. For instance, there was the case of O'Callaghan, for one, the half-crazy faddist, respectably connected, though of inadequate means, with his mad vagaries, among whose other gay doings when rotto, and making himself a nuisance to everybody all round, he was in the habit of ostentatiously sporting in public a suit of brown paper, a fact. And then the usual denouement, after the fun had gone on fast and furious, he got landed into hot water and had to be spirited away by a few friends, after a strong hint to a blind horse from John Mallon of Lower Castle Yard, so as not to be made amenable, under Section 2 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, certain names of those subpoenaed being handed in, but not divulged, for reasons which would occur to anyone with a pick of brains. Briefly, putting two and two together, 616, which he pointedly turned a deaf ear to, Antonio and so forth, jockeys and aesthetes and the tattoo, which was all the go in the 70s or thereabouts, even in the House of Lords, because early in life, the occupant of the throne, then heir apparent, the other members of the upper ten and other high personages simply following in the footsteps of a head of state, he reflected about the errors of notorieties and crowned heads running counter to morality, such as the Cornwell case a number of years before under their veneer, in a way scarcely intended by nature, a thing good Mrs. Grundy, as the law stands, was terribly down on, though not for the reason they thought they were, probably, whatever it was, except women chiefly, who were always fiddling more or less at one another, it being largely a matter of dress and all the rest of it. Ladies who like distinctive underclothing should, and every well-tailored man must, trying to make the gap wider between them by innuendo and give more of a genuine fillip to acts of impropriety between the two, she unbuttoned his, and then he untied her, mind the pin, whereas savages in the cannibal island say, at 90 degrees in the shade, not caring a continental. However, reverting to the original, there were, on the other hand, others who had forced their way to the top from the lowest rung by the aid of their bootstraps. Sheer force of natural genius, that. With brains, sir.
So now we have a long paragraph of Bloom thinking. Obviously, he has been discouraged from the conversation. At this pertinent suggestion, Mr. Bloom, to change the subject, looked down, but in a quandary, as he couldn't tell exactly what construction to put on belongs to, Ireland belongs to me, and he doesn't quite follow what he means, to which sounded rather a far cry. The rebuke of some kind was clearer than the other part. Clearly Stephen, in a way, indicates he doesn't want to talk. Needless to say, the fumes of his recent orgy spoke then with some asperity in a curious bitter way. With some asperity in a bitter way, if you had to explain asperity, you would probably say that means bitter. So again, you can see how clumsy sometimes the style is that wants to be elegant and literary. Curious bitter way, foreign to its sober state. Probably the home life, to which Mr. Bloom attached the utmost importance, had not been all that was needful. Now we know that Bloom's home life isn't all that great. Or he hadn't been familiarized with the right sort of people. With a touch of fear for the young man beside him, whom he furtively scrutinized with an air of some consternation, remembering he had just come back from Paris, the eyes more especially reminding him forcibly of father and sister. We've heard that before. Stephen looks like his father and his sister, the eyes. Failing too, throw much light. And you realize when you look at the syntax, it doesn't. What is the subject of failing to throw much light? Probably means all of this doesn't throw much light, but the syntax is often askew and strange, and that's intentional. However, he brought to mind instances of cultured fellows that promised so brilliantly, nipped in the bud of premature decay. You know, you can be nipped in the bud, that is very early. But what is a bud of premature decay? Bud is developing, decay is the opposite. So construction, bud of premature decay, is of course ridiculous. And nobody to blame but themselves. For instance, there was the case of O'Callaghan, and we saw him on the way to the funeral. Again, a lawyer who has come down socially. O'Callaghan, for one, the half-crazy faddist, a fad is a sort of the fashion, respectably connected, though of inadequate means, with mad vagaries, among whose other gay doings, when Rotto broke and make himself a nuisance to everybody all round, he was in the habit of ostentatiously sporting in a public suit of brown paper. So he does that. But also notice, he was in the habit of sporting a suit. Habit can also mean suit. So there are all these little awkwardnesses that happens when we speak, of course, and also when you write. Some of you have some experience, will know what it is when you suddenly catch yourself at saying something redundant. A fact, whether that's a fact, we don't know that somebody says that is a fact. And then the usual denouement, after the fellow had gone on fast and furious, he got landed into hot water. Landed into water. And had to be spirited away by a few friends after a strong hint to a blind horse. What is a strong hint to a blind horse? There's a saying, a nod is as good as a hint to a blind horse. It doesn't need them anyway. From John Mallon of Lower Castleyard, this is some detective who was actually, and we wouldn't see it from here, he was very, very famous because he had caught the murders of the Phoenix Park murders. It was he who found out, and so he had become very famous. Of Lower Castleyard, so as not to be made amenable under Section 2 of Criminal Law Amendment Act. This was an act that dealt with sexual misbehavior, a recent one. Certainly, names of those subpoenaed, when you're subpoenaed, you have to come to court under punishment when you don't punishment. Penaed, being handed in but not divulged. And sometimes in these cases where the nobility was engaged, the names were not mentioned, but just passed from lawyer to judge and so on. For reasons which will occur to anyone with a pick of brains. Briefly, putting two and two together, 616, I don't quite get that. I mean, two and two putting together is not 16. And remember the 16 on the chest of the sailor. So I don't quite know what the numbers do here. Which he pointedly turned a deaf ear to. Antonio Anto IV, that is the man who did the tattoos. Jockeys and Estes and the tattoo, which was all the go in the 70s or thereabouts, even in the House of Lords. Because early in life, the occupant of the throne, then heir apparent, the other members of the upper ten and other high personages, simply following the footsteps of the head of the state. And again, look at the footsteps of the head of state. He reflected about the errors of notorieties and crowned heads running counter to morality. Here you have heads running. And, such as the Cornwall case, which was a sort of homosexual case. A number of years before, under de Vinier, in a way, scarcely intended by nature, homosexuality was considered not according to nature. A thing good Mrs. Grundy, as the last one was tearing me down on. I don't know if you know Mrs. Grundy. She is the personification of morality and censorship. Mrs. Grundy doesn't allow. Very Victorian. Though not for the reason they thought they were, probably. Whatever it was, except women chiefly, who were always fiddling more or less at each other. It seems when women are intimate, it doesn't matter so much. It's not such a scandal. It being largely a matter of dress and all the rest of it. You see, Bloom here is thinking, it's in a way interior monologue stylized to language, and it goes from one thing to the other. And of course, the sentences then become very long. Ladies who like distinctive underclothing should, and every well-tailored man must, trying to make the gap wider between them. It isn't quite correct syntactically. They should make the, by innuendo and give more urgent Philip to acts of impropriety. An act of impropriety is, of course, a legal language. Say that. Between the two, and then he says some, he thinks some description. She unbuttoned his, and he then untied her. A kind of lesson, and this has to do with the fact that, as you say, sexuality was strictly taboo. But in court cases, when of course the evidence had to be produced, these things did come up that you could easily see as a witness describing what he saw, as he saw. And so the court cases were thrilling and were attended to, and the newspapers could read about them because they were facts of court. Mind the pin. Whereas savages in the cannibal islands say, 90 degrees in the shade, not carrying a continental. He probably means the savages at 90 degrees in the shade, they didn't have to wear clothes. However, reverting to the original, they were, on the other hand, others. There were, on the other hand, others who had forced their way to the top from the lowest rung by the aid of their bootstraps. Your eyes on the ladder from the lowest rung, but there's also an expression, you pull yourself out of a swamp by your bootstraps. So that gets mixed here. Sheer force of genius, sir, with brains, sir. Good, now we come.
For which, and further reasons, he felt it was interest and duty even to wait on and profit by the unlooked-for occasion, though why he could not exactly tell, being as it was already several shillings to the bad, having in fact let himself in for it. Still, to cultivate the acquaintance of someone of no uncommon calibre, who could provide food for reflection, would amply repay any small. Intellectual stimulation, as such, was, he felt from time to time, a first-rate tonic for the mind. Added to which was the coincidence of meeting, discussion, dance, row, old salt of the here-today and gone-tomorrow type, night loafers, the whole galaxy of events, all went to make up a miniature cameo of the world we live in, especially as the lives of the submerged tenth, viz. Coal miners, divers, scavengers, etc., were very much under the microscope lately. To improve the shining hour, he wondered whether he might meet with anything approaching the same luck as Mr. Philip Beaufoy, if taken down in writing. Suppose he were to pen something out of the common groove, as he fully intended doing, at the rate of one guinea per column, my experience is, let us say, in a cabman's shelter. The pink edition, extra sporting, of the telegraphic lie, lay, as luck would have it, beside his elbow. And as he was just puzzling again, far from satisfied, over a country belonging to him and the preceding rebus, a vessel came from Bridgewater, and the postcard was addressed to A. Boudin, find the captain's age, his eyes went aimlessly over the respective captions which came under his special province. The all-embracing, give us this day our daily press. At first he got a bit of a start, but it turned out to be only something about somebody named H. Du Bois, agent for typewriters or something like that. Great Battle Tokyo, love-making in Irish, £200 damages. Gordon Bennett, immigration swindle. Letter from His Grace William. Ascot, throwaway recalls Derby of 92, when Captain Marshall's dark horse, Sir Hugo, captured the blue riband at long odds. New York disaster. 1,000 lives lost. Foot and mouth. Funeral of the late Mr. Patrick Dignam.
Oh, for which and further reasons? What does the further really do to it? He felt it was his interest and duty even to wait on and profit by the unlooked for occasion. Though why, he couldn't exactly tell, being, as it was, already several shillings to the bad. He spent some money on Stephen, having, in fact, let himself in for it. Still, to cultivate the acquaintance of someone of no uncommon caliber, who could provide food for reflection, would amply repay any small thing. It's worthwhile, even if you lost a bit of money. And realize what he says, someone of no uncommon caliber. He means, of course, somebody of no common caliber, or of uncommon, but he gets it wrong, of no uncommon caliber, who could provide food for reflection with ample repay, any small intellectual stimulation as such. It's also a great phrase. What does as such mean? It was, he felt from time to time, a first-rate tonic for the mind. Added to which was the coincidence of meeting, discussion, dance and the brothel, row, old salt, the sailor of the here today and gone tomorrow type, night loafers, the whole galaxy of events, went to make up a miniature cameo of the world we live in. So he says, and in a way that applies to the book, all the people have is a little cameo, a small scale picture of the whole world. That is also what the Ulysses is. We live in, especially as the lives of the submerged tenth, that was a phrase at the time, those about whom nothing is written, with coal miners, drivers, scavengers, etc. And in this book, we have some of the submerged tenth. Well, very much under the microscope lately, the kind of sociology studies. To improve the shining hour, which is a quotation, he wondered whether he might meet with anything approaching the same luck as Mr. Beaufoy, remember, the one who wrote short stories and got paid for them, if taken down in writing. Of course, we understand what he meant, if something that he sees were taken down in writing, but grammatically, if taken down in writing, has no real place. Suppose he, Blue, were to pen something out of the common groove. Now here is out of the common groove, as he fully intended doing, that he really intends to write a short story. At the rate of one guinea per column, my experience, let us say, in a cabman's shelter. So in a way, Bloom thinks of writing something like the chapter he is in. And the chapter is also can be seen as how Bloom would write if he were trying to write with all these phrases and things that it is. Let us say in a cabin shelter. So Bloom as a potential writer of this chapter. Now, the pink edition, the evening edition was pink, extra sporting, of the Telegraph. And of course, the joke is telegraphic lie. And in this chapter, it's very often the question, what can you trust? What is dependable? And so on. Lay, as luck would have it, beside his elbow. And as he was puzzling again, far from satisfied, over a country belonging to him, that Stephen said, country belongs to me, and the preceding Rebus. You know, from all the newspapers, you had Rebus. Often there were builder rates at that time, but it's, Rebus is a riddle or something. The vessel came from Bridgewater, and the postcard was addressed to a Buddha, find the captain's age. And you're probably familiar with that choking question. The ship is so many meters long and 25 meters wide. How old is the captain? That sort of thing. His eyes went aimlessly over the respective captions, which came under his special province. So he looks at the headlines. Especially, all embraces, give us this day our daily press. And of course, Ulysses is also about one day. It's like a daily paper. First, he got a bit of a start, but it turned out to be only something about somebody named H. Dubois. Boys, of course, the eyes probably made him see Boylan first. Agent for typewriters or something like that. And these are now the events of the time. And they were all events of the time that were in the evening paper in the foundation. I could show it to you. You have all of this. Great Battle Tokyo. That was the war of the Russians against the Japanese sea battle. Love making an Irish to earn the damages. This was a case of you may know about breach of promise cases, when a woman had good reason to prove, often through letters or presents, that the man she had some relations with promised to marry her and did not marry her, she could sue for breach of promise. And that was that was very serious. Yeah, it could really. And so men tried to avoid it. So breach of promise was a kind of weapon. Don't forget, £200 was quite a lot. You could live for a year on that. Then there was the Gordon Bennett race that was taking place the next day in Germany, the Gordon Bennett race. Emigration swindle. Since many Irish were emigrating to the States or Canada, there was, of course, a lot of criminal attempts that they were cheated of their money and got no passage. That's what it is. Letter from His Grace William. It's great. The bishop wrote the letter. Ascot, the race of today. And then he said, throw away record Derby of 92 when Captain Marshall's dark horse, so Hugo captured the Blue Ribbon by long odds. So it is the result of the race is in the paper. And remember, throw away run it was called a dark horse that didn't have a chance. Blue Ribbon. New York disaster, 1,000 lives lost. That's another thing that had happened the day before and was in the newspaper. An excursion boat with women and children caught fire in the East River, and about 1,000 children and mothers were drowned or burnt. Foot and mouth, remember? Stephen had to carry a letter about the foot and mouth disease to the newspaper, and he came in. And then funeral of the late Mr. Patrick Dutton. And now there's also a report of that funeral, and that is then the next thought.
So to change the subject, he read about Dignam, R.I.P., which he reflected was anything but a gay send-off. This morning, Hines put it in, of course, the remains of the late Mr. Patrick Dignam are removed from his residence, number 9, Newbridge Avenue, Sandymount, for interment in Glasnevin. The deceased gentleman was a most popular and genial personality in city life, and his demise, after a brief illness, came as great shock to citizens of all classes by whom he is deeply regretted. The obsequies, at which many friends of the deceased were present, were carried out. Certainly, Hines wrote it with a nudge from Corney, by Messrs. H.J. O'Neill and Son, 164 North Strand Road. The mourners included Patrick Dignam, son, Bernard Corrigan, brother-in-law, John Henry Menton, solicitor, Martin Cunningham, John Parr, Eaton Diff, 1 and 8, Adore, Dorada, Duradora, must be where he called Monks the Day Father about Key's ad, Thomas Kernan, Simon Dedalus, Stephen Dedalus, B.A., Edward J. Lambert, Cornelius Kelleher, Joseph Mac Hines, L. Boom, C.P. McCoy, McIntosh, and several others. Nettled not a little by El Boom, as it incorrectly stated, and the line of bitch type, but tickled to death simultaneously by C.P. McCoy and Stephen Dedalus, B.A., who were conspicuous, needless to say, by their total absence, to say nothing of McIntosh, El Boom pointed it out to his companion, B.A., engaged in stifling another yawn, half nervousness, not forgetting the usual crop of nonsensical howlers of misprints. "Is that first epistle to the Hebrews?" he asked, as soon as his bottom jaw would let him in. "Text, open thy mouth and put thy foot in it." "It is really," Mr. Bloom said, though first he fancied he alluded to the archbishop till he added about foot and mouth, with which there could be no possible connection, overjoyed to set his mind at rest, and a bit flabbergasted at Miles Crawford's, after all, managing the thing there.
Yeah, and now we have a special occasion when the funeral that we attended on the 6 chapters is now reported in a newspaper. And you can see what happens when there's a report, though a funeral is not much of great interest. So, to change the subject, as Stephen said, he read about Dignam, R.I.P., rest in peace, requiescat in pace, RIP, which, he reflected, was anything but a gay send-off. And now we have to this report, and we can compare it to what we read in the 6th chapter. The report is in italics, cursive, and Bloom's thoughts in brackets are in Roman type. So good. This morning, and Bloom thinks, Hines, in the newspaper office, put it in. Of course, Hines is the one who wrote the report. The remains of the late Mr. Patrick Dignam were removed from his residence at number 9 Newbridge Avenue, Sandymount. That is where the address is, and that is how long ago I could take a picture of the house when I was in Dublin. For interment in Glasnevin. Interment is a little bit better than the other words. And then the deceased gentleman was a most popular and genial personality in city life, and his demise is a cut above his death, demise, after brief illness, came as a great shock to citizens of all classes by whom he is deeply regretted. That, of course, isn't quite true. It was a shabby little funeral, but, of course, in a newspaper, you're polite and turn it into a bigger affair. Wrong, but not seriously. The obsequies, and obsequies is also better. Normally, we don't get obsequies. Obsequies is the head of state dies or something like that. At which many friends of the deceased were present, and I already said at the time, it was a shabby, small funeral of 12 people, were carried out. And then Bloom thinks, certainly Hines wrote the note from Corney, by Messrs. O'Neill, Son, and Ostrander. This is the funeral establishment. And Bloom thinks correctly that the funeral manager there asked the journalist to put it in as a kind of advertisement. Wrote, And now the mourners included. Now there is nothing simpler than to have the list of names. Mm-hmm. And see what it is. And of course, it's in the order of importance in the funeral. First, the family. Patrick Dignam, the son. Bernard Corrigan, brother-in-law. That's the family. John Henry Menton, the solicitor. He is the highest ranking a lawyer. Martin Cunningham, John Power. We've been with them. And now you get something strange. You get just, it doesn't mean anything as far as you can tell. It is just a jumble of letters. That doesn't mean anything. Now, since I, for a long time, while I worked as a proofreader in a printer, I can tell, some other people can tell, what happened. There was a linotype before the computers where all the letters were in little compartments. And the linotype assembled the letters. They rolled down in a little channel and were assembled to a word in reverse. Now, sometimes the typesetter made a mistake and knew it. And rather than going on, he wanted to destroy the whole line, a line of type, and he just touched random letters to fill the line, and then there was the line was thrown out. But sometimes, and the older readers will remember, sometimes the wrong line was thrown out, and you got the old bad line was still in, and it made no sense. So it's a typographical hazard that can happen. In other words, nothing is perfect even technically. Okay. Where are we? Of course, I don't say that this jumble of letters doesn't have a secret meaning, but I can't. And Bloomfield must be very called monks the day for working. She said, Bloom remembers that this, somebody called monks, and Bloom thought when the type was set, that upset the writer, the typist. And then we have Thomas Kernan, Simon Dedalus, Stephen Dedalus, D.A., Edward J. Lambert, Cornelius Callagher, Joseph M.C. Hines, L. Boone, C.B. McCoy, McIntosh, and several others. And you see, I say it's not a big thing, and it's not a party issue. What happens? Thomas Kern was there, Simon Dedalus was there, Stephen Dedalus was not there. Stephen Dedalus, in the funeral chapter, was seen at the other end of the city. So by some reason, mistake or whatever, they put in the son's name too, though he wasn't there. Then, Edward J. Lambert was there, Cornelius Kelleher, that is the funeral undertaker, Joseph M.C. Hines, that is the journalist, and then L. Boom, remember, I'll look at it in a minute, they said, what's your Christian name? And he said, Leopold L., and so Bloom comes out as Boom. And you can see that for people like that, it's another insult when your name is misspelt in a thing. So, and then C.P. McCoy. Now, remember, just look up the passage now. Let me tell you. At the funeral, Bloom, this would be on your page 141, those are the Penguin edition, but not every service. Bloom thought the burial was over, Hines jotting down something in his notebook. Are the names? But he knows them all. No, coming to me. I'm just taking the names, Heinz said below his breath. What is your Christian name? I'm not sure. L, Mr. Leopold said. Leopold, says. And then he says, and you might put down McCoy's name too, he asked me to. Remember, in the fifth chapter, McCoy said, I would like to go to the funeral, but I can't. Do put down my name. And Bloom does it. So it says, and then, and tell us, Heinz said, do you know that fellow in there was over there in there? He looked around. McIntosh. Yes, I saw him, Mr. Rosen. Where is he now? McIntosh, Heinz, I don't know, is that his name? So what happened is Bloom himself gave the name of McCoy, who wasn't there, and he was, and the judge, and the man in there, and Bloom said, McIntosh. And the journalist obviously thought that was the name. So you see, out of the 12, four are wrong, and we can see why that is what happened. So in other words, you cannot trust even a harmless report like that, let alone when it's a political issue or a war report or something like that. Now, this is quite amusing. It shows how things can go wrong. But I also think this is a bit of realism. And something like that happened to me long ago. And I just mentioned it. We were in Dublin and we went to the school that Joyce had gone to. I walked around in the infirmary, the sick. There were very many rooms and very beds, walked around, and the priest who guided us said, the beds are very old. Maybe Joyce was sitting on one of them, or sleeping in one of them. So the journalist took people, the local guide from Dublin and me, and sat us on a bed in the room we happened to be, on the bed that had the best light from the window, and took a picture. And I wouldn't have known if a nasty friend hadn't sent me the clipping. I still have it somewhere, but I can't find it. But I know it by heart. It said, a picture of two silly looking people sitting on a bed. It said, Fritz Zinn, Z-I-N-N, and boom, president of the Joyce Society in Zurich, and John Ryan, president of Joyce Society in Dublin, sitting on James Joyce's bed. My name was misspelled. I was not, and nobody ever claimed there was no society, Joyce Society in Zurich. There was no Joyce Society in Dublin, and we were certainly not sitting on Joyce's bed. You know, when this happens to you, you believe it, and kind of thing. And so I usually... in your university, say to the younger people who still have a lot of their lives before them, not all of us have most of their lives still before them, but I say to young people to warn them, whenever you quote it, the best thing that can happen to you is that you look ridiculous. That's the best case scenario. And some of your burnt children, they know that. Good. That's an aside, but it's quite interesting. Nettles, not a little. El boom. Boom, of course, also means success, business success, you're right. Boom, as it incorrectly stated, and a line of bits type. This is a jumble of letters. But tickle to death. That's not true. He's not tickled to death. Simultaneously, by C.P. McCoy, the Navy, and Stephen Dedalus, B.A., who were conspicuous, needless to say, by their total absence, to say nothing of McIntosh. So Bloom remarks on that. L. Boone pointed out to his companion, B.A., as the newspaper said, engaged in stifling another yawn. Stephen is always yawning and tired and not interested, half nervousness, not forgetting the usual crop of nonsensical howlers and misprints. Now, Stephen, having pointed out to him the mistake, that he was in a different place, Stephen says, is that first epistle to the Hebrews? He asked, as soon as his bottom jaw would let him in. Text, open thy mouth and put thy foot in it. Stephen remembers that he brought the letter about the foot and mouth disease to the newspapers, and he wonders whether that is in. He had something to do, and he calls it the first epistle to the Hebrews. That's in the Bible, but of course the letter contained nothing about the Jews, but it was about cattle disease. But Stacy ended by saying that Ireland never let the Jews in, so it was also a bit anti-Semitic. So this is a kind of complicated thing. And the foot and mouth disease has often been said, whenever he opens his foot, his mouth, he puts his foot in it. So that's the kind of thing. In that first epistle to Hebrews, you can look it up and you'll find there is no first epistle to the Hebrews. There's only one. So again, that isn't reliable. It is, really, Mr. Bloom said. Though, first he fancied, he alluded to the Archbishop, the letter, till he alluded about foot and mouth, with which there seemed no possible connection. Overjoyed to set his mind at rest, and a bit flabbergasted at Miles Crawford, after all, managing the thing there. Miles Crawford, the editor, put it in, so Stephen knows that. Yeah, that is the episode of the report.
While the other was reading it on page 2, Boom, to give him for the nonce his new misnomer, whiled away a few odd leisure moments in fits and starts with the account of the third event at Ascot on page 3, his side value 1,000 sovs, with 3,000 sovs in specie, added for entire colts and fillies, Mr. F. Alexander's throwaway, B.H., by right away, 5 years, 9 stone, 4 pounds, Thrale, W. Lane, 1, Lord Howe de Walden's Infandel, M. Cannon, 2, Mr. W. Bass's Scepter, 3, betting 5-4 on Zinfandel, 20-1, throwaway off. Throwaway and Zinfandel stood close order. It was anybody's race. Then the rank outsider, due to the four, got long lead, beating Lord Howe de Walden's Chestnut Colt and Mr. W. Bass's Bay Filly Scepter on a 2.5-mile course. Winner trained by Brain, so that Lenham's version of the business was all pure bunkum, secured the verdict cleverly by length, 1,000 sovs with 3,000 in specie. Also ran J. de Bremont's French horse, Bantam Lions, was actively inquiring after, not in yet, but expected any minute. Maximum the second, different ways of bringing off a coup, love-making damages, though that half-baked Lions ran off at a tangent in his impetuosity to get left. Of course, gambling eminently lent itself to that sort of thing, though, as the event turned out, the poor fool hadn't much reason to congratulate himself on his pick, the forlorn hope. Guesswork it reduced itself to eventually. There was every indication they would arrive at that, Mr. Bloom said. Who, the other, whose hand, by the way, was hurt, said.
Yep. While the other was reading it on page 2, showed the run of the race, and there was in the paper, in the Evening Telegraph, there is a report on the race that George used. While I was reading it on page 2, Boom, to give him for the nonce his new misnomer, whiled away a few odd leisure moments in fits and starts with an account of the third event at Ascot on page 3. It was on page 3. His side, Boom is sitting on the right-hand side. His side. There should be a comma after side. It has no side value. A comma value 1,000 sovereigns. That was the prize. The prize you made sovereigns in Guinness. With 3,000 sovereigns in specie. That is all terms of races. Added for entire colts and fillies. Called young horses, fillies, female horses. Mr. F. Alexander's throwaway. So that, as you know, won the race. Bay, I think that means a bay horse. It's a technical term in racing. By right away. By the horse, the throwaway's father horse, sire, was right away. So from right away, you get the name Throwaway, which is an odd name for a horse. But I understand there are very strict rules about naming horses.
Oh, yeah.
5 years, 9 stone, 4 pounds, the weight, of course, Thrail, W. Lane. So the owner is mentioned, and the coach, and the jockey, Lane. Lord Howard de Walden, Zinfandel, and two. So this is the order of the races. Mystery Barsi's Scepter, three. Barsi's Scepter, these horse owners are usually quite rich. Barsi was a brewer. Ordinary people don't have horses. Betting price for Zinfandel, 20-1 throwaway off. And then there's a report of the race center, and Zinfandel stood close order. It was anybody's race, and then the rank outside the dude to the four got long lead, beating Lord Howard de Walden, Chestnut Colt, and his Moss Bay Filly Scepter on a 2.5 mile course. That is racing terminology. Winner trained by Brain. So that Lennon's version of the business was sold to a banker. Lennon had told for us in the 14th chapter what happened. He had read the account, and Bloom thinks Lennon didn't get it right. Secured the verdict cleverly by a length. They always say how much a whole length is, or a head or something like that. 1,000 sovereigns with 3,000 species. Also ran J.D. Brehm's French horse, and this is the famous one. He also ran French horse. Bantam Lions was actually acquired after, not in yet, but expected any minute. So remember, Bantam Lions asked Bloom for a look in the newspaper, and then he thought Bloom had given him a tip. And his favorite was Maximum II. Now from here, you can read the story backward. What happened in the Cyclops chapter, what happened in More Than Rocks, what happened in the fourth chapter, or the fifth chapter. So here it comes together. Different ways of bringing off a coup. Love making damages. Now he reads again the other headings. Know that half-baked lion ran off at the tangent in Pizzioti to get left. That is the scene at the end of the fifth chapter. Remember, Bloom said, keep the paper, I was going to throw it away. And Bantam Lions thought that was a tip on throwaway. Choice. Bloom didn't know that. And we certainly didn't know that. Now it comes together. Of course, gambling eminently lent itself to that sort of thing, though, as the event turned out, the poor fool hadn't much reason to rattle himself on his pick. The forlorn hope, guesswork, it will use itself to eventually, yeah, who wins, raises guesswork. There was every indication they would arrive at that, Mr. Bloom said. Who? The other, whose hand, by the way, was hurt, said. No. So that is the episode of the newspaper. And we can still do a next lot here.
One morning, he would open the paper, the cabman affirmed, and read Return of Parnell. He bet them what they liked. A Dublin fusilier was in that shelter one night and said he saw him in South Africa. Pride it was killed him. He ought to have done away with himself by laying low for a time after committee room number 15 until he was his old self again, with no one to point a finger at him. Then they would all to a man have gone down on their marrow bones to him to come back when he had recovered his senses. Dead he wasn't, simply absconded somewhere. The coffin they brought over was full of stones. He changed his name to Duet, the Boer General. He made a mistake to fight the priests and so forth and so on. All the same, Bloom, properly so dubbed, was rather surprised at their memories. For in 9 cases out of 10, it was a case of tar barrels, and not singly, but in their thousands, and then complete oblivion, because it was 20-odd years. Highly unlikely, of course, there was even a shadow of truth in the stories, and, even supposing, he thought a return highly inadvisable, all things considered. Something evidently riled them in his death. Either he petered out too tamely of acute pneumonia just when his various different political arrangements were nearing completion, or whether it transpired he owed his death to his having neglected to change his boots and clothes after a wetting when a cold resulted, and failing to consult a specialist, he'd been confined to his room till he eventually died of it amid widespread regret before a fortnight was at an end. Or, quite possibly, they were distressed to find their job was taken out of their hands. Of course, nobody being acquainted with his movements even before, there was absolutely no clue as to his whereabouts, which were decidedly of the Alice Were Out There order, even prior to his starting to go under several aliases, such as Fox and Stewart. So the remark, which emanated from friend Tabby, might be within the bounds of possibility. Naturally, then, it would prey on his mind as a born leader of men, which undoubtedly he was, and a commanding figure, a six-footer, or at any rate 5'10" or 5'11" in his stocking feet, whereas Messrs. So-and-so, who, though they weren't even a patch on the former man, ruled the roost after their redeeming features were very few and far between. It certainly pointed a moral, the idol with feet of clay. And then 72 of his trusty henchmen rounding on him with mutual mudslinging, and the identical same with murderers. You had to come back. That haunting sense kind of drew you to show the understudy in the title role how to. He saw him once on the auspicious occasion when they broke up the type in the Insuppressible, or was it United Ireland, a privilege he keenly appreciated, and in point of fact handed him his silk hat when it was knocked off, and he said thank you, excited as he undoubtedly was under his frigid expression, notwithstanding the little misadventure mentioned between the cup and the lip, once bred in the bone. Still, as regards return, you were a lucky dog if they didn't set the terrier at you directly you got back. Then a lot of shilly-shally usually followed. Tom, four, and Dick and Harry against. And then, number one, you came up against the man in possession and had to produce your credentials, like the claimant in the Tichborne case, Roger Charles Tichborne. Della was the boat's name to the best of his recollection. He, the heir, went down in, as the evidence went to show. And there was a tattoo mark, too, in Indian ink. Lord Bellew, was it? As he might very easily have picked up the details from some pal on board ship, and then, when got up to tally with the description given, introduce himself with, excuse me, my name is so-and-so, or some such commonplace remark. A more prudent course, Mr. Bloom said to the not over-effusive, in fact, like the distinguished personage under discussion beside him, would have been to sound the lie of the land first. That bitch, that English whore did for him, the Shebean proprietor commented. She put the first nail in his coffin. Fine lump of a woman all the same, the swarthy son town clerk, Henry Campbell, remarked, and plenty of her. I seen her picture in the barber's. Her husband was a captain or an officer. Aye, skinned the goat, amusingly added. He was, and a cotton ball one.
Yeah. One morning, so they talk, you would open the paper, the cabman affirmed, and read, Return of Parnell. Now, Parnell, the Irish leader with great hopes, died about 12 years ago, and his followers weren't much. And Parnell is one of the big figures because he nearly led the Irish to have home rule independence, but he died. He bet them what they liked. That's all interesting. I say, I bet you what, like that somebody is coming back. It's not the bet that anyone can take up, but that's what you say. Dublin Fusilier was in that shelter one night. He said he saw him in South Africa. I say, great men don't die. They always come back. Barbarossa, whatever it is. South Africa. Pride, it was, killed him. He was a very proud person. He ought to have done away with himself or laying low for a dime after committee room number 15. The whole story is behind it, and Joyce never gives us the facts. He just, people who think about it, like Bloom or Talk, they know it, and we don't. Now, it was that Parnell was about to succeed and make a contract with England when it was discovered that he had an affair with a married woman. Now, that was already known, but nothing was made of it until a divorce case came, and Parnell, it turned out, was an adulterer. And that meant that the church sided against him, dropped him. And in his own party, this be Catholic Ireland, many fell off, and there was a vote in committee room number 16, and he was deposed of the leadership, and the rest of the time he tried to fight back and get it, but then he died very soon. Committee room number 15 was an important decision. Until he was his old self again, with no one to point a finger at him. So Bloom thinks, or they say, he should have hidden away a little bit. Then they would all to a man have gone down on their marrow bones to him to come back when he had recovered his senses. He should have waited and then come back. Dead he wasn't, somebody says. Simply absconded somewhere, hidden somewhere. The coffin they brought over was full of stones. He died in England, and the coffin was ceremoniously brought to Ireland, but there was a rumour he wasn't in there. The coffin was full of stones. That also, something similar happened when Yeats died in France, and they brought back the body. Some people said the body never made it to Ireland. Yeats' grave may be empty, or things like that. But so was full of stones. All rumours, of course. Mm-hmm. He changed his name to De Wet, the Boer general. He became De Wet, the Boer, to fight against the English, so that the English, the South African president De Wet would have been. Of course, in the whole chapter, you never know who is really who. Who is the sailor? Because Odysseus, when he came back, made all kinds of false biographies of how he came here. He made a mistake to fight the priests, and so forth and so on. At the same time, Bloom, properly so dubbed, was rather surprised at their memories, for in 9 cases out of 10, it was a case of tar barrels. When somebody had a triumphant entry, they had fires on tar barrels in celebration. And not singly, but in their thousands, and then complete oblivion. You become famous, then they forget you. Because it was 20 odd years, not quite, but it was 20 years is the time that Odysseus was absent from home. I liked it, of course. There was even the shadow of truth in the stories, it says, but it should be in the stones, meaning the story about the stones. And even supposing he thought a return highly inadvisable, still, all things considered, something evidently aroused them, his followers, in his death. Either he petered out too tamely of acute pneumonia, and that is what happened. He, a great man, a great hero, died because he hadn't changed his socks and had caught pneumonia, which is not the heroic death, you know, on the battlefield. Just when his various different political arrangements were nearing completion, or whether it transpired, he owed his death to his having neglected to change his boots and socks, while you have wet feet, and clothes after wetting. When a cold resulted and failure to consult a specialist, he being confined to his room till he eventually died of it, amid widespread regret before a fortnight was at end. Or quite possibly, they were distressed to find the job was taken out of their hands. So this is the story behind it of Parnell. And Joyce has Parnell in every one of his books, but it's never explained because the people know. Of course, nobody being acquainted with his movements even before, and Parnell, outside of Parnell, led a very secluded life. Nobody knew where he was. He was often, actually, where he was very often in the apartment of his mistress in Brighton. There were absolutely no clues as to his whereabouts, which resulted in Alice, Where Art Thou, Order. That's another poem of somebody who is missed or lost. The chapter is four stories of homecoming or not homecoming. Or even prior to starting to go under several aliases, he had several other names, such as Fox and Stewart. He called himself Mr. Fox or Mr. Stewart, ordinary names. So the remark which emanated from friend Cabby might be within the bounds of possibility. Naturally, then, it would prey on his mind as a born leader of men, which undoubtedly he was, and a commanding figure, a 6-footer, or at any rate 5'10", 11 in his stockinged feet. And it's when you think of a great man tall and you imagine him in his stockinged feet. Nobody looks, I venture to say, great in his stockings, in his socks and things like that. Well, as Mr. So-and-so, though there weren't even a patch on the former man, ruled the roost, that are in command, after their redeeming features were very few and far between. It certainly pointed them all. The idol with the feet of clay. You know the story in the Old Testament? There was a statue of, I forget whom, and had feet of clay. Turnerne. So that is, the fundament isn't all that secure. So the idol has feet of clay. And then 72 of his trusty henchmen rounding on him with mutual mudslinging. And there was this meeting where some of his party colleagues turned against him. And the identical same with murderers. You had to come back. That haunting sense kind of drew you to show the other study in the title role how to. He saw him once on the auspicious occasion when he broke up the type in the insuppressible, or was it United Ireland newspaper, and what happened when Parnell was deposed from his head, the newspaper went to the others, and you know it's always important to have control of the media. Now it's the television. And so he wanted back the newspaper, and that was really an occasion. The previous senior priest, and in point of fact, handed him the silk hat when he was knocked off, and he said, thank you. So Bloom was there, and there was this fight around about the newspaper, and Parnell dropped his hat, which we heard the report really happened, and who put it up but Bloom? So this is when he rubbed shoulders with history, and he got the thank you. Excited as he was under his feigned expression, not as a little misadventure, meant between a cup and a lip. There's many a slip between the cup and the lip. A lot of things can happen when you don't expect them. What's bred in the bone, what do you learn early? Still, as I got returned, this is an interesting set. He said, you were a lucky dog if they didn't. And he wants to say, if you return, so you're a lucky dog if they don't set the dog on you. And everyone who has spoken knows that kind of situation when you certainly should say the same word and it isn't good, and the last moment you change it and they didn't set the terrier on you. Now, a terrier is not a particularly fearful dog, but it is that kind of thing when you catch you and you can't say dog again. You got back. Then a lot of silly shy usually followed Tom Four and Dick and Harry against. And then, number one, you came up against a man in possession and had to produce your credentials. And now he turns into a famous lawsuit. Sometimes you have to hide your identity, it's better. Or sometimes you have to prove your identity. Right now, with our computers. like the claim in the Tichborne case. The Tichborne case was a very famous thing, that a rich aristocrat drowned in a shipwreck in the Pacific. And nobody knew, and there were advertisements, if you find him. Then there was somebody, an Australian man, who claimed that he was, that was him. And he went to London and presented himself and claimed that the mother believed it. And there was a big lawsuit, and it turned out it was a fake. He wasn't. So, and that was a really new. You can look, if you look up Tichborne case in the on the web, you find a lot about that. It's very complicated. Bella was the boat's name. The best result there went down as evidence went to show. There was a tattoo mark in engineering. For example, tattoo can prove who you are, because not everyone has the same. Lord Bellew was it. And he might have well easier picked the detail from St. Palom board. So that is what Bloom thinks about it. And then when you got up to Tully with the description, introduces it, excuse me, my name is so-and-so. Wasn't from those mark. A more prudent course, Mr. Bloom said to the not over-effuse, in fact, I did see Mr. Ferdinand discussed beside him, Stephen, like Parnell, didn't care, would have to sound the lie of the land first. It would have been better to look around and make sure of the facts. That, again, I don't know here if Bloom is thinking this or if he's speaking it. He might well say it. In fact, it seems so. And the others talk about Parnell. That bitch, the English whore, for him, did it for him, the Supreme Provider commented. It was the woman who was his downfall, and she's called the bitch. She was English. Did for him. Shebeen is a place where they sell illicit alcohol, not the real public house. She put the first nail in his coffin. Fine lump of woman, all the same, the Swadlingshire town clerk, Henry Campbell, remarked, and plenty of her. She must have looked quite attractive. I'd seen her picture in the barber's. Her husband was a captain or an officer. It was Captain O'Shea and Kitty O'Shea, that was the name, and she's a famous, notorious woman officer. I seem to go to the music that he was, and the cotton ball one. Cotton ball must mean not very active one or not very virile one. I don't quite, I try to look up if cotton ball is any kind of idiom. But of course, cotton ball is something very soft and not hard. Yeah, this is a good place and to stop here and, with all the details and the oddities. Next time, as I said, no reading. I won't be here. Hope you enjoy it then. Thank you.
Goodbye.